some extent help us to focus our attention in a particular place and provide us with particular kinds of understandings that can be very helpful to us. But we all know well that labels obscure just as much as they reveal. When we decide that this person is a Roman Catholic and this person is a Protestant, it's done. Decision's over. I know what you think. You're white. You're black. You're gay. You're bi. I don't know what that means. But we fish you. Right? This is what we do with labels. We pin people, things, communities, countries, ways of life down. We nail it down good. We don't like the obscurity. I mean, we don't like the messages that comes with the lack of labels. I remember once when I was living in Belgium, an American woman was coming to a conference that we were having. It was a conference on the Hebrew Bible. And she stormed into the conference desk and she said, "There are no labels on the bathroom." "I can't go to the same bathroom where men go." I said, "Well, then I guess you're not going to go to the bathroom." I mean, if you have so fixed in your categories that you can't go anywhere in the bathroom, I think the problem is yours and not ours. It is a country full of unisex bathrooms. So you're just going to have to. But the other thing I think about is I think we use labels as a way to shield ourselves from the most challenging truths about our lives. Because labels help us keep certain things away from our thoughts. They hide things. And of course we know when we use those labels, then we hide too. This gospel passage that we hear from John, majority of chapter 4, I think in some ways has been a good example of what happened with labels, this process of labeling. So I would imagine almost every person in this room would know what the label is for this gospel pericope, this passage. What is it? The woman at the well. Or the Samaritan woman. That's what this passage is about. And truthfully, there is some deep truth to that. That this passage is about the transformation of a woman by the person of Jesus who decides to cross the boundaries, the social, the political, the religious boundaries that are part of his day. To cross those boundaries in such a way that it transforms her life. And so we see at first she calls him the Jew, then she calls him Sir, and then she says, "Are you the Messiah?" You see this transformation happen in her life, and so then she goes out and becomes one of his disciples. This woman who had grown dry under the burden of many labels, Samaritan, woman, a woman with five husbands, and then another man-canyon now. Six in a row. Suspect. And of course, John doesn't tell us any for any reason. He leaves those reasons out of why she's had five husbands and a lace man. That is not important. Even though over the years we try to add that in. We try to make this story, because we think the story is about her, right? So that's what happens, is the label focuses us in on this woman and her story of transformation, and then we over-read the text and supply all these other things into it. This is a great story about Jesus coming to this woman of ill repute and transforming her life. Jesus comes into this moment, engages her in conversation. And she doesn't just engage her in conversation. They have kind of a slam-bang debate. I mean, he just doesn't say, oh, it's so nice of you, it's so good, and here I am talking to you. Isn't that good of me to be talking to you? Isn't that that bad? He's like, he starts debating with her about religion, about what they believe. He takes her seriously, and she pushes back. That's one of the things I love about John. The characters are so strong. You can disagree with them, but at least they're strong enough to have that in the background. This woman has background, and Jesus talks with her. And then when it comes up that she does have five husbands and another man, he's not scandalized by that. He doesn't start into a lecture. He doesn't start into a little, well, love the sinner, hate the sin. He doesn't come into any of that. But he talks to her. Now, what did the disciples do? Our ancestors, the other disciples, because I'm going to call her a disciple. What are the other disciples, the ones who have been coming with her? They come back. They find good food. And they come back, and here he is. Jesus, sitting at this well, talking to this Samaritan woman. And John says, and they were astonished. They were shocked. I can't believe he's talking to that. And then John says, they didn't ask him, but they were thinking about it. What do you want with her? Why are you talking to her? Now see, this gets me. This is the part of the passage that just grabs me and holds me tight. What? You know, John says that they were thinking this, but we don't know that from the fact that they actually said it to Jesus, which means that they must have been talking amongst themselves. And you can picture it. So remember, I asked you to expand this picture of the woman at the well to include not only Jesus, but these disciples. And you can see them all huddled in a circle, and they're shocked. They probably didn't even come too close. And they're not going to enter into that conversation. They do not talk to that woman. And they do not even talk to Jesus. But instead, they gather around and imagine, what is he talking to that woman for? What does he want? What does he want with her? The thing is that they don't ask him, probably because they don't really want to know the answer. But I think that part of the reason why they don't ask the question is because they can't imagine any possibility that he would ever want to talk to her. These disciples suffered from a failure of imagination. It was impossible for them to believe that Jesus could actually want to do it. So why bother asking him? It's not even, I mean, it's there, right? It's happening right in front of them, but they still can't believe it. Now, the thing is, my fear, as I said earlier, about the fact that we've labeled this passage in a particular way to obscure the dynamic that's happening with the disciples, my fear is that this is a pattern of life in the Christian community that continues to go on. You know the pattern. We don't talk to people. We don't engage them in conversations. We don't ask, certainly, what God would possibly want from them, even though we may think it. But instead, we huddle around amongst ourselves and talk about it. In the meantime, I must admit I take great heart that there are disciples, many here, in fact, who are not doing what these other disciples have been doing. That they are crossing boundaries, they are challenging labels, they are actually engaging people about their own life transformation. It's happening. It happens here in this community all the time. I see it. It happens in many denominations. Real conversations. Transformative conversations about people's transformation. Where people start to flow with living water. Many of you are nodding, you've been there, you've heard those, you've been part of those conversations. I'm grateful that I belong to the Metropolitan Community Church that's dedicated to that, to seeking out those people who have been labeled, pushed aside, driven out. Let me tell you, they come to our doors every day. Every service, they come dry. Sometimes thrown out by family, thrown out by their church, thrown out by their school, nowhere to go. But these people are finding transformation. They are finding life. They are finding living water in the Christian community. And they're finding living water in themselves, welling up. God's very life dwelling up in them. MCC now is in 20 different countries. As a matter of fact, we're going to open up a church in Nigeria this summer. Every year, we're committed to opening up 50 new churches in the next 10 years. We'll probably surpass that. We're already way above what we need to be at this point. And that should tell us something as a Christian body about what's going on. Now, I have to say, I do sympathize with these disciples that have just brutally chastised. I have sympathy for them. You know, that's probably why I'm so aggravated with them, because I see myself in them. You know, it's not, like I said, it's not just about the LGBT people. But we can all add our list in there. And I dare say that some of the people in this room would be included. If the truth be told, some of us would say, well, you know, I could do without them. I could do without the evangelicals. I could do without the high church liberals. I could do without this group or that group. I could do without the Republicans. I could do without the Democrats. And the independents, they drive me crazy. They make up their minds. We all do this. This is not something that happens outside, out in the world only. It happens here amongst ourselves. And I don't say that to chastise ourselves, to chastise us, but to say that we're part of all of this. We participate in this labeling process. But we also do those other things that I mentioned earlier. We transgress those boundaries every day. We engage people in conversation. We ask them about their authenticity. Ask about their life. We listen for the ways in which they seek to be faithful to the gospel. We listen deeply for their desire for a deeper life. See, the irony to me is that when we choose to ignore the fact that God's life is bubbling up, gushing out, pouring forth from somebody else, especially from a person that we think doesn't count, doesn't belong, God has no interest in, we are the ones that are shutting ourselves out. We are the ones that are withdrawing ourselves from the community that God is creating among us. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't want to be there. If God is gushing forward, out, transforming, bringing new life in somebody's life, I'm going to be there. I'm going to be in that community. Don't you? We don't want to be in a place that says, I don't want to be there. I don't want to participate in that. I can't believe that. So, the invitation is ours. The choice is ours. What kind of disciples will we be? What kind of community will we be? At least, we set the bar very low. We can at least ask God, what do you want of them? Whoever they are. That's, I think, the minimum we can do. But I would like to propose that we do even more than that, that we continue to do even more of what we've been doing, and that is hear the testimonies of people who have been transformed by the living Word of God. Regardless of whether we think they count or not, whether they fit into our categories or not, whether they belong to another nation or not, whether they fit into our easy categories of Christian or non-Christian or Muslim or Jewish or Buddhist, we listen for their testimonies of what's happening in their life. I think we can do that.